substance necessarily on the overview of the system, and we're going to get into a little bit more of the community organizing aspect of this. We have Abraham Daniels, who is the capacity building manager at Capital Community Health Network. He's responsible for advocacy and program development involving quality improvement, emergency preparedness, workforce development, and clinic operations. He came to his organization in 2008 after working as a deputy director for operations for an FQHC, member federally qualified health center, in Helena, Montana. And prior to that, he worked at an FQHC in Kansas City, Missouri. So I think this is great. He's got more of a general nationwide perspective on some of the stuff that he can bring and help us all out in Sacramento. So Abraham, the mic is yours. And after his presentation, we'll allow a few minutes for questions. And there's your mic there.
Thank you, everyone. Again, my name is Abraham Daniels, and I'm actually fairly new to California. As Bruce had mentioned, last year I was living in Helena, Montana, so around this time we still had snow on the ground, so I'm glad to see that the sun is out. But again, I'm with Capital Community Health Network, and we're one of the 14 healthcare consortiums in California. And our role is to support the continued growth of the Safety Net clinics here in Sacramento. Today my speech is going to be on health delivery and the Safety Net. So we're going to talk about strengthening the partnership with the Safety Net community health centers. We're also going to be talking about the special election, just briefly, the budget cuts, Senate Bill 810, and then the opportunity for grassroots advocacy here. Here's just a brief list. Actually, this is the list of all the community health centers here in Sacramento. Thanks to Lola and her staff, there's copies in your packets here. But as you're aware, based off the economic crisis here, a lot of people are losing their health insurance coverage. And more people are accessing primary health care through the use of the emergency rooms. So it's important to be aware of that these patients that are the newly uninsured, underserved, and Medi-Cal patients need an appropriate medical home. And we can serve those populations here in Sacramento with these agencies, which can provide appropriate medical homes. Again, as a consortia, our job is to strengthen the continued growth of these agencies. We provide advocacy, quality improvement. We're also strengthening our emergency preparedness. As Dr. Trochet had mentioned, the H1N1 incident, we have worked with the county to provide immunization and medication for a lot of those patients there. We're here in Sacramento. As well as we do workforce development. But we work together with all the 14 consortia to strengthen our communities, as well as we work with California Primary Care Association. I'm going to just briefly go over some of the clinics here in town. We've got the Effort Medical Clinic. They just recently received their federally qualified health center designation thanks to the President Obama's stimulus bill. We've got a couple other clinics that have just received their federal designation, and I'll briefly talk about what that really means and the benefits of that. We've got Health for All, Sacramento Community Clinic, and then Sacramento Native American Health Center. They actually received their Indian Health Service designation. Two other clinics that are working to get their federal designation, and which could really use your help in terms of advocacy to get them the designation that they need, is Midtown Medical Center and Sacramento Community Health Center. So briefly about these clinics, they're located in Sacramento, and the type of population that we're going to be serving are the uninsured, again, underserved, and the Medi-Cal. And the mission of these clinics and where they're located is in the underserved areas, and that's through they're called medically underserved areas, and I'll briefly talk about what that really means. But the effort, they receive federal funding. So thanks to the stimulus bill, their core grant basis, and their core funding comes from the federal government. They receive matching dollars from the state. Again, that combined funding source that they get is able to leverage their medical services when they provide it to the community. Again, all these clinics, their core service is primary medical services, and some of the clinics also provide dental and behavioral health, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. Sacramento Native American Health Center is our only Indian health services. They provide dental services. Again, they're open to everyone regardless of the ability to pay. And that's the mission of all these community health centers. If you don't have income, they'll work with you based on a sliding fee scale. Is everyone aware what that really means? That basically means that they'll look at your income, and if you're at a 200% poverty level, they'll work with you to get a percentage of that bill paid off. As you already read in lots of newspapers, the highest percentage of bankruptcy for a lot of our citizens is because of health bill coverages and the lack of insurance. These community health centers will work with you to pay off your bills, as well as there's other benefits by getting the designation. You get price pharmacy purchasing discounts. Some of you had mentioned that you're having trouble accessing some of your medication. Well, they partner with the pharmaceutical companies, and if you meet their eligibility requirements, you're able to get free medication. A lot of people might be aware of that, and a lot of people might not. As well as a lot of our clinics, because Sacramento is so diverse, they focus on a particular demographic. Sacramento Community Health Center is our Latino-based clinic. A lot of clients that speak Spanish predominantly go to that clinic. We also have a Slavic community served by the Midtown Medical Center. They provide actually physical therapy with their clinic, and as well they provide transportation. So if you live in an area and you need to get to Midtown Medical Center, they will actually transport you from your house to one of their locations. They actually have two locations, one in on J Street and also in West Sac. Again, all these clinics are listed on in your packet here. And then we've got Health for All and Sacramento Community Clinic. They focus on the Southeast Asian Hmong population. Again, much needed services for throughout the demographics that we serve. Again, you might be aware of the healthcare issues when it comes to access and the barriers that are created with our healthcare system. Lack of transportation, language, and more importantly, access to healthcare, and more importantly, specialty services. But our clinics are able to provide some of those. We also represent specialty care clinics, Bi Valley Method Medical Center, their methadone clinic. The Birthing Project, they're helping reduce infant mortality. Yes, so I'm fairly new, so I'm still getting used to all the clinics. Women's Health Specialists, they provide not only women's health education, but they also provide training for men on health services. And then we got the Health Education Council. So this is our group of that we represent when it comes to our consortium and when it works for advocacy. We also do a lot of grant writing, and we also do partnerships with the community, especially working with your organization, the county, and that's what we really need going forward here with the budget cuts, is strengthening our partnerships with our counties. All these clinics, we already talked about the type of clients that they're going to be serving. But what they do need is funding. And with the budget cuts, those are definitely impacting how we're going to be looking forward with our healthcare delivery system. And I'm going to talk about that briefly. We talked about dental services. There's going to be a significant impact to the Native American clinic. They're the only clinic in town that, again, operates on a signed fee scale for dental services. There might be a loss of staffing. There's definitely going to be a reduction in dental services for our for the clients that we serve. Out of all the primary care clinics, last year we served 20,000 people and about 57,000 encounters. As Dr. Trochet had mentioned, there's 1.4 million people in Sacramento, and there's 180,000 people that have Medi-Cal. That's the golden ticket for a lot of these clinics, the community health centers. The federal government has recognized that these clinics are serving the uninsured clientele. And so they get a higher reimbursement when it comes to Medi-Cal and Medicare. Again, I'm going to repeat that. They get a higher reimbursement. But that coverage is to cover the cost of an uninsured person. So you see, one Medi-Cal patient should, in theory, cover the cost of two uninsured individuals. But the challenge that we have in Sacramento is that we have so many clients, but they're not getting to the clinics that we need to be seen at. And that's where the community can help educate, not only if you know people that are on Medi-Cal, or if you can help educate your representatives and also the hospital community about the importance of sending those clients to these type of clinics. Again, I'm not trying to segregate that population, but what the benefit of a community health center is that we're able to leverage the services. Not only are we able to provide private medical, but we're able to establish a medical home. Emergency rooms are not a medical home. They are not a medical home, and we need to get our people that are needed the services to these clinics. A lot of these clinics are located on a bus route, and that's important. If you're homeless, you can get on a bus and you can get to the location. What we do really good in this community is homeless services. You've all heard about the tent community, and last week at Sac City, we had a Homeless Connect where we partnered up with the local homeless initiative to provide services for the homeless community. So on certain things, this community does really good. We've also partnered up with the county for immunization for children, vaccine for children. Again, with the county budget cuts, there's a limitation that Dr. Trochet and her staff are able to provide. And it's really unfortunate that our core services are being redefined because of the budget cut. But our clinics are stepping up to that challenge. But again, if we're only able to serve the uninsured, and if that means 80% of our client base are people that are actually going to be paying maybe $5 or $10 of the bill, that's going to be a challenge for us to keep our doors open. And a lot of our funding, Health for All, everything under the effort is only receiving state funding. The effort it has the benefit of receiving federal funding. And the need for the community and your group to contact your representatives to help them get their designation is that they can get this base funding. When the budget isn't being impacted, the clinics below the effort, their Medi-Cal rate is being changed. The core funding that they have for dental, the eligibility requirements, the children's services, these are all programs that we have fully supported, and we know people that are accessing these services but don't have a medical home. These are the homes that they can go to, but the services are going to be challenged. We've also talked about the specialty care services. We are working with our entire consortium to build a stronger referral base. Children that are coming to Bi-Valley or the Birthing Project, their parents that might be eligible for Medi-Cal services, we're going to send them to one of our clinics here. We're also trying to build a stronger partnership with the hospitals, but that's going to take some time. And I think as a budget crisis, there's going to be opportunities. And I think that's the biggest thing as we go forward, is that there are opportunities. We can't always be looking at the negative impact of the budget cut. We're going to be thinking outside the box. And I hope as we move forward that the county and the rest of the system looks towards our members, because I think they have the capability to step up. It's a big challenge. They've also been around for a long time. I think we're going to go to the next slide. We're going to talk just briefly about the Community Health Center program in itself. They've been around since the 60s through the Economic Opportunity Act 1964 through the Johnson administration. So they've been around about 40 years and more. But the importance is that the federal government has realized the importance of serving everyone regardless of the ability to pay. As well as our clinics are located in rural and urban areas, and more importantly, in the uninsured area, underserved areas. Under the designation of community health centers or federally qualified health centers, there are migrant healthcare worker programs, there's homelessness, there's Indian health services, and community health centers. These are all the designations under an FQHC. So someone as well mentioned, and Dr. Troche had mentioned, federally qualified health center lookalikes. I briefly mentioned that. That they only get the state reimbursement. They do not get the federal core funding that we need. The community health centers, they're located in high need based off the community, and that's important to realize as a community health centers evolve with the need of the community. And the need of the community right now is access to health care. They're governed by a community board, so 50% of the board is community-based. That's where you have the opportunity as a user or as a community representative to be a participant in their board. It's important that if you're not involved, it'd be a good opportunity to learn what some of the issues are, how you can be support them. They provide comprehensive primary health care, as well as health education. Again, the community that we're serving, the trust when it comes to health care and the government is really fragmented. And so our clinics work to educate a lot of our clients on best practices. We're tied to a standard of joint commission. Some of you may be aware of that, but we also look at evidence-based outcomes. So we're working on diabetes, hypertension. We're looking at developing better systems within our primary care clinics. We provide service to all, and I'd mention our accountability. And there's a lot of financial reports. It is amazing how much time we have to spend when it comes to documenting the amount of paperwork when it comes to receiving reimbursement. But we won't turn you away if you don't have the proper documentation to receive services. We'll work with you, but you will get a bill. But again, the big thing is that you're getting the health care that you needed. There is a wraparound at the end of the year. We do a cost-based report so that we can capture the cost of that we lost by providing the services. Again, when you hear not-for-profit, all these clinics are not-for-profit, and it is the reality. They are living on a but there's no profit, basically, break-even profit. And so we're out there running for grants. We're basically on our knees talking to everybody who is out there to give us some funding. You talked about the quality of the healthcare. Yes, our buildings might not be the best looking, but we do tie them to a high standard of quality improvement. And that's one of the roles that I'm in charge of here in Sacramento for our consortium, is bringing our system up for quality improvement. So whereas the rest of the nation is looking at healthcare reform and access to healthcare through the thanks of President Obama stimulus bill, California, unfortunately, we are redefining how we look at healthcare. We are cutting so many services, it's too sad to even think about. But President Obama, in the stimulus bill, there's $2 billion for community health centers. Again, $2 billion. Dedicated to those clinics that, and throughout the state. $500 million for healthcare workforce development. Again, $500 million to provide medical staff to work at the clinics. We're being challenged because of the salaries that our community health centers can offer when a hospital system can offer a higher rate or definitely a private practice. Medical schools, a lot of the students are going into specialty care, and they're not going to primary care health services. A lot of our clinics, we staff mid-levels, those are called nurse practitioners. We utilize medical assistants. We're using a different staffing mix, and it's important that the community realize that you're getting the same level of quality of health care. You don't have, granted, Dr. Troche is an MD, but we're able to still get this quality of health care. So I'm just going to briefly talk about these different propositions because it's the budget. We already know that these were all voted down, but there's two of them that would have impacted us if they were voted yes. 1A really didn't. It's not really going to impact us. It's about the rainy fund. 1B education fund. It's important that we support our funding for the schools. But if we can go to 1D, protect children's service funding. So that's basically taking to, I guess,
I interrupt just for a moment. Can I, will you turn that button on? Your mic is not working.
Oh, it's on. He's not speaking. Just hold it a little higher.
A little bit higher. There. Is that better?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. So, 1D is taking the tobacco tax money to protect children's program and temporarily redirect the funding for general funds. So, everyone's aware of the First Five program. And this program here, this proposition would provide services for children 5 and under, and they'd be able to continue their services. And those are the arguments for it. The argument against that is saying that it would remove $1.6 billion from providing local health and education programs established by First Five. First Five here in Sacramento recently put a funding proposal out for dental services. And that's important because the rest of the state is looking at cutting our dental reimbursement. And a lot of our community health centers, again, are getting a higher reimbursement for dental. But if the reimbursement's not going to be there, they're really treading lightly in determining if they should be opening up dental services. First Five has given our clinics an opportunity to provide dental services for the pediatric population. So we are going after some of that funding, so keep your fingers crossed, and one of the clinics in town will be hopefully receive that funding to get a new dental clinic here. As mentioned, the only dental clinic in town is a Native American clinic. They operate on a sign fee scale, so if you have dental need, they'll do the best that they can to get you into their clinic. And then 1E, mental health funding. This is basically transferring the funds for 2 years to fund early and periodic screening. So this would basically save the general fund, but what it would do is Proposition 63, which is helping about 200,000 people which are needing mental health services, including 50,000 children, would have been impacted by that. The effort, their foundation was on behavioral health services. Some of our clinics, we are seeing right now the need for behavioral health services, and a lot of our primary care providers are doing the best that they can to solve that need. You already heard about the jail system as being the primary home for a lot of our behavioral health clients, and which is very unfortunate. But we need to strengthen that partnership here in the community and the awareness about the stigmatism about behavioral health. If you do have a need, that stigmatism when it comes to work or your personal life. And so a lot of our clinics work on health education and the benefits of receiving services. And again, we're trying to strengthen our partnership when it comes to specialty referrals to these behavioral health services. But I believe the effort is the only one right now that has limited behavioral health services. All the others we're applying for funding, again, through the feds, but again, those are being challenged by the budget cuts as well. Just next slide, please. So here in California, the proposed budget cuts, the governor is relying on $1.25 billion. And so basically, this slide is just basically talking about the human health and human services. So a lot of the cuts to Medi-Cal. They're going to be changing the Medi-Cal optional benefits. Again, that's our dental benefits, optometry, and psychology. We worked in collaboration with the California Primary Care Association to put a legal stop to that. So on June 12th, there will be a hearing, and so we encourage citizens to be at that hearing here in Sacramento, again, June 12th. If you need more information, I can send it to Lola about the time and location. But it would be great if our citizens can be there when we hear the testimony and the judge's response. Again, they're going to be changing the eligibility requirements. They're going to be restricting Medi-Cal just for emergency use. Again, we briefly talked about emergency rooms are not medical homes. And again, we're redefining how we're looking at healthcare here by changing it to only limiting to emergency use for undocumented immigrants and then newly qualified immigrants. As well, just again, there is a complete elimination of adult day healthcare program and expanded access to primary care. So that's going to impact our Indian Health Service programs, or a lot of our rural health programs that our consortium members represent. So one by one, these primary medical homes are going to be eliminated because of the budget cuts. Now, that's going to be devastating for the community. More importantly, the people that live in rural areas are going to be having to figure out a way to come to Sacramento. If there's no bus route, I'm still learning the transportation system here, but it seems very fragmented, just like our healthcare system is. So we'll go to the next slide. Senate Bill 810, we strongly support that, community health centers. Basically, Senate Bill 810 is to talk about universal health coverage in all community health centers. That's our mission right now, serving everyone regardless of ability to pay. We'll be working through our primary care association to provide support for this initiative. We'll be looking to our community to help us out on that. But the important thing is that we support that. It's going to be providing the necessary medical home that a lot of these clients need. It's going to be providing the essential primary dental and vision services. I think we're going to hear a little bit about that, more about the Senate bill this afternoon. But the important thing about the benefits of this is that everyone's going to receive the coverage that they need. And that's important in this day and age. As well as the services that they need and the services that they're not getting here right now in the county, with some of the services for the undocumented and the documented clientele. And so what we need as we move forward is to look at an opportunity for the grassroots advocacy. And that's where you, as members of the League of Women Voters, can help us at the consortia and help our clinics out. Again, I'm going to keep referring back to that sheet of clinics there, because we can really utilize your expertise and your ability to help us when we don't have the staffing capacity to be at the Capitol or to make the phone calls. Again, our clinics might have about 4 or 5 administrative staff for serving about 57,000 people. That's really limited. When they talk about administrative overhead, that's malpractice coverage that we're talking about. But the benefit that our community health centers have is that we get the federal coverage when it comes to malpractice. What we don't have is the funding. So an administrator might be the CEO, might be the advocate, he might also be the social services person, he also might be the behavior health therapist, and maybe even the dentist, just pull out his tooth. But so how can you help us out? You can participate on boards. You can help us by volunteering. Again, that might be being a greeter, that might be helping out with medical charts. If you have that skill set, you can be a patient advocate. Assist with voter registration. I know that your group has really helped out with the ballot initiatives, and we continue to need your services at the Community Health Center. Again, we are non-bipartisan, but your support may be helping the clients that are needed, that need to be voting, that don't know how to vote or are not registered. This is where your services are needed. And we're doing this at the grassroots level throughout the state, and we're trying to build that program up here in Sacramento. So anybody can help me help that program out. Letter campaigns. Again, I mentioned two of our clinics, Midtown Medical Center, Sacramento Community Clinics. They're needing that federal designation. If you can contact your representative, if you ever use their services, to tell them about the need to get that clinic designated. Rallies. We're going to be having a couple of rallies here. Again, we're all waiting, holding our breath about the July 1st budget cuts. Myself and throughout the consortia, we're on weekly conference calls talking about what's happening with the budget. And we're looking to put a rally together, partnering up with other groups to let our legislators know what's the impact. Behind each of these budget cuts is an actual person that's being impacted by the programs. And again, it's the community needs to be aware of it. I'm glad that this group is giving us the opportunity to educate you about community health centers. Again, I want to thank you for your time. I'll be able to take some questions here.
Okay, remember, we're going to get to the
some brochures and then a business card. So if anyone would want to be able to contact me as well. But you can go to the next slide. I've got my email right up here. We do have a webpage, www.capitalhealthnetwork.org. We've also built a Facebook page, so if anyone's out there using Facebook, want to be our friend.
Can you hear?
Yes.
Question was, have these clinics that do not have the FQHC designation, have they made application?
Yes.
Okay. Because I am a board of the, I'm on the board for the El Dorado Community Health Center and just followed my doctor there, and I was amazed to learn what they do. And I think a lot of people don't know what they do. So that was my pitch, just to understand. And by the way, that was about the only thing that President Bush did in his entire tenure was to support FQHC.
And if anyone ever needs an opportunity to work on it, I'd be more than happy to help arrange that so that we can, if you want to go take a look at the clinic and just see what kind of services they provide.
I'm Carolyn McGrady. I'm with Healthcare for All. Is this still working?
No. I was thinking that there really was a really great entrepreneurial opportunity here for clinics. And I was just looking at the principles that Obama has asked, and that, you know, that cost gets under control and that patients get choice. Now, he does say choice of coverage, choice of doctors, but I really think that I've heard him say a lot of times the choice of your own doctor and medical home, and then that we have affordable and quality care. How do you see these changes, whether we get the single payer right away or whether we go through some morphing of other ways of providing universal care? How do you see that changing? How do you see the folks that come to you now? But where are they going to be getting care, and how are you going to compete to provide the kind of care that you would really like to provide, knowing that you would be paid the same way any other doc system, you know, is going to be paid?
Thank you for that question. I think this is an opportunity. As we continue these discussions, I think the biggest thing, as you look at the single payer, is having the right people at the table for these discussions. Right now, it's limited on when it comes to the community health center, when it comes to representation at these discussions. There's a lot of hospital representation, there's a lot of lobbyists at the tables. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know if we heard that, we don't have any money, we're broke. So our partnerships come with the community, building our partnerships with the county, building it with the Primary Care Association. And so what we need in order to be at the table is a voice of our citizens, a voice of our users, the voices of our representatives to give us that opportunity. And only in the past 5 years or so, I would say, even in Kansas City and Montana, and even so here, that community health centers have been able to come to the table when it comes to talking about healthcare and the delivery of healthcare services. Thanks to President Obama, we are receiving some of that funding, that $2 billion, but thanks to the budget cut, we probably won't see any of it. So I think the biggest thing as we go forward is that it's the opportunity to educate who's at the table, because I think when you don't know what's on the other side, that's when you become scared. And community health centers, our foundation, are community-based. So there's about 46 million people uninsured. We could go and open up right across the street. I don't know who else we're going to be competing, because they don't have the same income that the services that we're going to provide. Going under single payer spreads out the playing field. And I think, like I said, going forward, we just need to have the opportunity to be at the table to talk about that. You're asking about veterans and then how the county is able to help out?
Correct. Because, like I said, the fastest growing member of the homeless population now is the VA does not understand the homeless. We're out on the streets that they serve our country. So 1 in 4 homeless are veterans. Veterans administration hospitals are so overloaded, they don't even understand our needs.
Well, basically, the gentleman's asking about our women, men and women that are served our community or served our nation, and then as they're coming back to the States, a lot of them are post-traumatic services, and they're also homeless. How is our community responding, more importantly, the county and our community health centers responding to the need of our men and women? So first, I think the main thing is that we want to thank them for serving our country. But more importantly, here at the county, we're trying to build that partnership with the county when it comes to homeless services. The effort, Sacramento Community Clinic, we're working in partnership with the county to provide some of those services, but it is a growing challenge. As I mentioned, there is federal funding to become a community homeless program. Again, that's getting core funding. I'm not aware of.
Well,
and I'll kind of defer to the doc over here.
I'm sorry to tell you that actually homeless services are proposed to be cut. And at the hearing on the 11th of June at the Board of Supervisors, there is a proposal to eliminate the shelters, the homeless shelters that the county funds because of the budget crisis. So that is an issue that you all might want to look into. The hearing will be at 700 H Street, starting at 2 o'clock.
I don't know if everyone heard Dr. Trochet. She had mentioned that a lot of the health, the homeless programs are going to be cut. And what date did you say, Don?
June 11th.
June 11th. So again, a lot of the homeless programs are going to be proposed to be cut here. That's also going to impact a lot of the shelters.
People are making a connection between the cost of this war, these illegal occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the effect it has on our economy. How long are we going to keep funding these wars and losing these soldiers?
That's another day.
I mean, it's all tied to
that. Of course it is.
So I think the main thing is that there's an opportunity as citizens to be at this hearing because of the homeless shelters and the homeless programs being cut. There's also an opportunity to let your voice be heard. This is a great opportunity for you to make your voice be heard at this presentation. We're all aware of the situation. It's not like we're oblivious to it. I think especially this group is completely aware of the situation at hand. And I think you are the right individuals to go on the stage to make your voice be heard, because that's the great thing about this nation, is that we give you the opportunity to let your voice be heard.
It isn't about liberating. It's about liberating these people from their oil.
Okay.
Well, I would just like to make a comment here about so anybody that has their hand up can take information, or you can come and see me. If you would like to be on our mailing list, you don't have to join. We just want people to be advocating, because these cuts that are being proposed at both the state and the county level are devastating. We are going to see people dying on the streets. I have no doubt about that whatsoever. In fact, I was just telling Elaine that if I'm uninsured and if I get really sick, I'm going to tell you right here, I want to be dragged into Dave Cox's office. And I want to die right back in front of him. If you're interested in coming to any of these meetings, we need to do something. These are desperate times for both levels.
Thank you.
Abraham, thank you very much. Excellent presentation. I also want to know, Glenn, you know that the cut hearings, you just mentioned the clinic system being on the bus lines. You should know that Monday, the regional transit headquarters, this coming Monday, they will be hearing a proposal to cut the routes about 50%.
50-50.
Yes, to deal with a $6 million shortfall. So not only, this is affecting everything. The whole infrastructure is falling apart. People are not going to be able to get around on this system. Now, I go on public transit. I use it to see what it's like. And even at its component right now, it's woefully inadequate. And I only live 6 miles from the downtown where I work on a regular basis, so that's another important issue. Thank you very much, Abraham, and we'll be organizing there. Our next speaker, like Glenna Trochet, is a distinguished physician activist in this community. We often see him at legislative hearings, supporting key public programs. Dr. Wang is a pediatrician and a child and adolescent psychiatrist with 31 years of experience. He's a member of a group that I think we all have tremendous respect for, Physicians for Social Responsibility. I think a lot of us have grown up and identified that with a great scientific and professional organization that's opposed the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And if that isn't a public health issue, I don't know what is. I worked for a director of health services back in 1978, Bev Myers, that actually made that part of her public health platform, the issue related to nuclear weapons. But it's the Physicians for Social Responsibility endorses the principle that access to timely, high quality, and necessary health care without regard to one's income or ability to pay is a basic human right.
Absolutely.
And of course, they've been a strong proponent of single payer, Sheila Kuehl, 840. We have Sarah Rogers here to talk about the great bill by Senator Leonard. But with no further ado, Dr. Wang.
Thank you, Bruce, for those kind words, and thank you, Healthcare for All, for putting together this forum. And PSR is proud to be one of the co-sponsors today. Our local chapter has been a supporter of single payer for a number of years, and I'm proud to announce that just a few months ago, our national organization, Physicians for Social Responsibility, is endorsing single payer nationally.
Right.
Just 2 days ago, a mother called, a mother of one of my patients, and left a message on my voicemail. I've been treating her 11-year-old son who has autism for the last 2 years. And this is the message that she left on my machine. Quote, "We have a little soul problem. I got laid off in May, and it's taking a while for COBRA benefits to kick in. I went to get his monthly medication and was told it would cost $638 for the month. And this is someone who is on one medication, one pill a day, $638.
$20 a pill.
Pardon?
$20 a pill.
$20 a pill. She went on with her message, "We can't afford this. Is there a cheaper generic medication alternative that he can take?" Unquote. Now this family has already suffered enough. The child's father had a stroke 2 years ago. He's been unemployed since. They still have medical bills pending from the hospitalization and then the medical care and physical therapy. And this autistic boy's behavior has worsened over the past year, and it's taken a while to find an adequate medication approach. And of course, the child wasn't just receiving medication, he was at a special school, he was getting services through the regional center. So medication was just a piece of it, but it has become an important piece of his treatment. So I had to go look in my electronic database, like all doctors do, see what medications are, try and find which ones are less expensive. You have to familiarize with the costs. Look at alternatives. I called the parent back. We went over what some of the possibilities might be. And we agreed to talk again, or I would actually see the child next week to see how he was doing. Now, unfortunately, this is a common story that we all hear and that doctors hear almost every day. Insurance, as we know, is usually dependent on employment. And insurance for children is dependent, by and large, on parents' employment. And we also know that medication costs are totally out of control. Now, just yesterday in the Sacramento Bee, I think this was mentioned earlier, there was a headline in the business section entitled "Medical Bills Call Up Last Straw. Study sees tie to most bankruptcies." And what this article was referring to is a study that's going to appear in the August American Journal of Medicine. And this study reports that 62% of all personal bankruptcies in 2007 were attributed to unaffordable medical bills. 62%. So at first glance, that's too bad that these people don't have adequate insurance or that don't have any health insurance. But when you read it, 3/4 of these individuals who filed for bankruptcy had health coverage. 3/4 had health coverage, and yet it led to bankruptcy. So all of the out-of-pocket expenses are what makes it even more difficult for families, especially in today's economy. The writer noted the urgent need to overhaul our country's healthcare system in a way that addresses the high cost of medication and the diminishing access to quality care, especially among the poor and uninsured, as we've heard already this morning. I think we all know that about 46 million Americans were uninsured in 2007. Another 25 million adults between the ages of 19 and 64 were underinsured in 2007. So if you add that up, people have calculated that up to 42% of US adults between the ages of 19 and 65 were either uninsured or underinsured. That's 42%. Now if you break it down by ethnicity, about 10% of non-Hispanic whites were uninsured. This is nationwide, about 10%. 20% if you were African American, 17% if you were Asian, 32% if you're Latino, and 30% if you're Native American. So there's wide disparities in health coverage based on the ethnicity. Now the consequences of this lack of care are predictable, and yet they're very severe. There's, of course, greater financial stress. There's higher access problems. There's more disrupted relationships with healthcare providers. There's less preventative care. There's more serious illnesses, there's less treatment for these illnesses, there's more complications from these illnesses, and ultimately, there's more premature deaths from these illnesses. An example of this would be, we know from many studies that those who are underinsured or uninsured have higher rates of deaths from illnesses such as strokes, heart attacks, cancer, and serious injury or trauma. Now, in spite of all the highly trained and dedicated specialists, generalists, nurses, technicians, state-of-the-art hospitals, the United States ranks 19th out of 19 industrialized countries in deaths due to treatable conditions. The Institute of Medicine estimates that as many as 24,000 people die each year in the United States because of lack of health insurance. That's 24,000 excessive deaths. I think many of you know that we are the only democratic, Western, industrialized country in the world that does not have some form of universal health care. And yet, we spend twice as much per person for health care than in any other industrialized country. And yet, we rank in the bottom third of most of the overall measures of quality of care measures that we have. Now, it's heartening that we're meeting today to see what we can do about it. And it's heartening to me as a physician to see that more doctors and organizations are joining in a call for universal health care. In 2002, a survey of doctors found that 49% supported government legislation to establish national health insurance. That was in 2002, and 5 years later, this has gone up by 10%. And in one study, 59% of physicians expressed support in national health insurance, and a study reported in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Another survey of physicians in 2009 showed that 90% of physicians felt that all Americans should receive medical care regardless of ability to pay. 90% of doctors agreeing with all of our citizens that we should be able to have health care without regardless of ability to pay. And only 9% of physicians prefer the current employer-based financing system. Thank you. 42% of doctors in this study preferred single-payer health insurance. So while that may seem low, it's slowly coming up. And the following organizations now endorse single-payer health insurance: the American Medical Student Association, the American Medical Women's Association, American Public Health Association, American College of Physicians, which just endorsed last year, Physicians for Social Responsibility, the American Nurses Association, of course, our California Nurses Association, and the National Association of Social Workers. So why are an increasing number of physicians supporting universal health care? Well, first, I think physicians are concerned about the well-being of their patients, and they realize that the current system isn't working. I think by far that's the number one reason. The doctors also oppose spending an average of 14% of their income on billing and insurance matters. It's a big expense for physicians and physician offices. Physicians also oppose the 20 to 30% that the insurance companies spend for administration, for their overhead, and for payment to their CEOs. And physicians also oppose monies that end up going to the drug companies for their profits, and are opposed to drug companies being able to spend more on marketing than on research and development of newer medications.
And lobbying,
of course. It's shameful that our country does not take care of our citizens and chooses not to make our health and well-being a priority. We always have money for the military, as Daniel stated. We have money to bail out Wall Street, but where is the money for our health care? Now is the time to bring about change to our entire health care delivery system so that everyone has access to health care. So I say, Healthcare for all, single payer is the best way.
You have any questions for Dr. Wang? I think we're not quite ready to have you get your sandwiches yet. Anybody have any questions? We're going to have you come up here.
Dr. Wang, I have a couple questions. One is, could you comment on what this does to the Healthy People's programs of the PPC and other federal organizations that set goals for public health in this country? And also, could you talk about the politics among physicians? I've heard it described as being quite brutal for those that want to step out from the sort of the herd and actually come out for what they are, obviously by the polling, clearly moving in the direction of supporting. But that's only one step, and the other step of getting active and becoming politically involved seems to be a really hard thing for physicians to do. So I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Well, I'll start with the second question, but hang on, I'm not sure I caught the first question, so but let me start with the second question. I think it has been a slow, it has taken time for physicians to come on board. The 2007 study that I referred to showed that physicians that are in primary care, pediatrics, family practice, OBGYN, and psychiatry, 60 plus percent of those specialties tend to support universal health care, whereas some of the other specialties, less so. So I think politically it is difficult because of the influence of the health plans and the pharmaceutical companies. But I'm not sure I understood your first question.
My first question is about the Healthy People. 2010 and 2020, they're being 2020 plans have been formulated now,
yes,
to be released probably in a year or two. So I'd like to know, or maybe Dr. Crochet would be a better person to ask this question, but what does this economic disaster that we're living through, how does that totally set, or at least partially devastate the whole goals of Healthy People? Maybe you will try to first.
Healthy People 2010 is a set of goals that the CDC set for the nation to reach so that our nation would be healthier. And some of the goals, for example, are reduce infant mortality, improve life expectancy. I have to tell you, in Sacramento County, we did not attain most of the Healthy People 2010 goals. We're now working on Healthy People 2020 goals. And many of those are going to be addressing health disparities and the fact that some portions of our population are less healthy and attain worse outcomes than other portions of our population. I'm pretty sure that what is going on with this huge depression that we're all undergoing, it's going to affect everyone in the United States attaining those goals. In the United States, more so than in any other developed country, health and wealth go together. If you are poor, your health is worse. The better off you are, the better off your health is. That's not true all throughout the world. It is true in this country. So since so many people are going to be impoverished, I'm pretty sure that our health will be affected.
Okay, we're going to want to move this along and just take one more question.
Okay, hi. I heard in your speaking points that you use three different terms: national health, universal health, single payer. What Obama's proposal in his principles is supporting is a single payer insured organization. I have a problem with an insurance company administering a single payer system. The other thing that bothers me is the undefined character of those three terms. I have in my mind what I think each one of them means, and it makes a difference when you're thinking about how to design and implement a system which you're talking about. So could you offer some clarification and speak to the issue of any plans for who would administer a single payer insuring option? You know, would it be subcontracted out to an insuring organization with 20-30% overhead? You know, like we've got now, which I don't think is a step forward, or can we leap into universal health care, which to me is a national health care system where prices are set based on potentially, I forget the term, but it means recognized, sorry, I'm blocking, it's recognized practice models. You know, proven medical care. I'm sorry, it's a confused question, but it just is such a complex issue.
I think that the terms are not exact, and certainly the studies that I quoted from weren't necessarily they weren't corresponding to the same exact term. I think the studies show that doctors are wanting coverage for all the citizens, for all their patients. But how that's going to be done, I think there's quite a wide range of opinion. Physicians for Social Responsibility support single payer. We do not believe that just having health insurance companies provide the care, for example, as in Massachusetts, is necessarily going to reach the goals that we want in terms of cost and sort of in terms of the care that we want. So we support single payer that would go into a fund that which would be administered and then distributed to providers. The providers would not be employees. We're not talking about socialized medicine. We're not talking about physicians who are employed by the government. We're talking about socialized delivery of health care in the sense that everyone would be able to get good quality care.
Okay, we're gonna take one last comment and question.
It's just a comment.
Well, that's important.
Okay.
Nancy Campbell, member of the League of Women Voters, American Association of University Women, which has been supporting single payer since it was called SB 910. privately delivered, publicly financed. Remember that term when you get socialized medicine thrown at you. Susan DeMauro, the head of the California Nurses Association, was written about in today's New York Times, and I just want to read this short. She said, "The Max Baucus and others are getting to know us very well. In a press conference, DeMauro blasted the conventional wisdom that single payer is not politically viable. Quote, is it politically viable to let people die and suffer from a lack of political will? Noting the fight for women's suffrage and the civil rights movement, she emphasized we're going to have to turn up the heat. Women did not get the right to vote by voting on it."
That was a great comment. I want to thank Dr. Wang for all his great work in the community and the participation. And before we break for lunch, I want to leave you with just one thought. What I picked up on CNN today is the Republican leadership in the Senate is telling, when it was referenced that the Obama organization is now, the election group is now turning into a grassroots organizing organization to deal and express their wishes on this issue. The Republican leadership said they better not raise too much of a ruckus, because if they do, this isn't going to happen. This is a quote directly on CNN, so you guys better shut up. Okay, let's have, I'll let you talk after the... Right, exactly. So we're going to go back, get your lunches. Remember, we've got recycling over here for your cans. Please sit down. We're not going to have much of a break for lunch, about 15 minutes. We'd like you to have a discussion among yourselves about next steps, what you want to do to follow up to these meetings in terms of actual action in the community and supporting services. We'll be starting with Sarah Rogers